This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of May 25th, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 397. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And on the big deal feature, as the first session since last fall's provincial election winds down, I welcome the leader of British Columbia's official opposition, John Rustad of the Conservative Party of BC. Could another election be closer than you think? This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. My guest this week is John Rustad, the leader of the Conservative Party of BC, the opposition in the British Columbia Legislature, and the MLA for Nechaco Lakes. In the space of a year and a half, the Conservative Party went from zero MLAs to 44 MLAs, came close to winning the 2024 election. And actually, before I get on to talking about this current legislature session, I want to get from you the latest on the controversy around potential voter irregularities in the Surrey-Guildford riding.
So first of all, thanks for having me on. It's good to see you. It has been quite a journey, certainly as the Conservative Party. And, here we are 8 months after the election, and there's still stuff hanging on there because of the irregularities that have happened and during the election. The things that we have discovered, not just in the Guildford riding, but in other ridings, are shocking. The fact that Elections BC does not check to see if you're a Canadian citizen. Found many cases of people who are not Canadian citizens who voted. We found many cases of people who even asked Elections BC if they were Canadian citizen. Elections BC response to the person who told us was, no, actually, nobody checks for that. And that to me is one huge flaw in our system. But that isn't really actually even connected to the Surrey-Guildford case. The Surrey-Guildford case is going to court. I think it'll start possibly as early as Monday here of next week. On the 26th. We'll see how that proceeds. It's going to be quite interesting. The NDP lawyers, I believe, are arguing that the whole process should be delayed. I think Elections BC is going to be looking for a publication ban in terms of the information coming forward. So we'll see how all of these things play out once it actually gets into court. But the good news is the chief judge in the province has said that this is a case of significant public interest. So they've advanced the case to this spring. It was originally going to be scheduled for the fall. They have a senior judge who has been assigned to the case. So I'm confident it'll have an opportunity for a good hearing.
And going into the final week of the spring legislative session, for you as leader, what have been the highlights and the lowlights for you and your caucus?
Well, going into the session, we had so many new people. It was an unknown. How would they perform? How would we be able to, as a Conservative caucus, be able to hold the NDP accountable? And I have been incredibly proud of our team. The way they have performed the legislature as their critic roles, the way they have been speaking in the legislature, whether it's question period or whether it's to various bills or other statements in the legislature, everybody has really risen to the occasion. I'm really proud of what we have as a team. So it's been good. And as an opposition, I've been in government, as you know, for a long time, or as an MLA, I should say, for a long time. And I have never seen a government in such disarray in coming out of an election and having the spring session, having a throne speech, having a budget. And all of that has landed flat. They have, they've just been going from crisis to crisis, from scandal to scandal in terms of the way they're doing things. And it's, if this is where they're at in the first year coming out of election, I shudder to think of what it's like if this carries on much longer.
So in March, the NDP tabled a budget with a $10 billion deficit. And about as soon as the budget hit the table in the legislature, they changed gears. They turned into a campaign against Donald Trump and his tariffs. And that became David Eby's singular focus. How has that caused the Conservatives to change gears?
Well, it hasn't actually caused us to have to change much at all. The interesting thing is when we asked the minister about the budget, she said, oh, it's just a snapshot in time. I'm sorry, the budget is a prediction of what will come for the entire year. You're doing processing, you're doing projections, you're putting in contingencies in place so that you can meet your budget targets. Not just a snapshot in time that changes on a day-to-day basis. It's crazy to think that's the way they're budgeting. And according to Moody's, and of course, we've seen two debt downgrades in British Columbia now to we've lost our AAA status in this province. And according to Moody's, they think the deficit's going to be $14.3 billion. My guess is it's even going to be higher than that by the time we get through this year, simply because of the very bad management that we have with the NDP. But when you look at what they've brought forward with this, I mean, they have literally done nothing. They except for thump their chest and say they're going to fight Trump, even though, you know, Carney's backed down now and shut down all of the countermeasures, all the counter tariffs. You know, David Eby hasn't changed his tune. And he's asking for these authoritarian powers, this ability to be able to override legislation, this ability to be able to avoid scrutiny and any kind of reporting or public disclosure in terms of what they're actually going to do. As well, of course, is giving them the ability to move forward projects that they pick and choose. And whether that's First Nation-owned projects get to get the fast track, everything else has to, you know, basically put off to the sideline. It's just not the way to do it. Government should be setting the stage for solid and economic opportunities in this province, and then judging projects that come forward based on that as to what is in the interest of British Columbians, not David Eby's handpicked few.
And yeah, the carbon tax was reset to zero. It wasn't repealed. It wasn't axed entirely. It's still there in the books, but it's reset to zero after the federal government set the tone. And David Eby had to fulfill that promise he made after doing the flip-flop before last fall's election. But the big question the Conservatives were asking was, what is that going to mean for the provincial finances? That's a large line item cut out of the budget on the revenue side. Well, how is that going to affect the rest of the budget? You still don't have the answer there.
No, we don't. Matter of fact, we've got finance estimates coming up this coming week in the legislature, and so we're going to be asking some more questions about that. But it punches a $3.2 billion hole in their budget. Now, some of that, of course, was the rebates that were going out to people, about $1.2 billion. So it's a net about a $2 billion hole in their budget that they have not planned for, even though they knew this was coming. And they even refused to tell us when they started planning to do this. And it's crazy how secretive these guys, like, what are they trying to hide? I thought the whole idea of government was it's government for the people. You know, you should be transparent about the things that you're doing. But regardless of that, you know, when you look at what they've done here with that, with the carbon tax, they have left the legislation in place in case they want to bring back in a carbon tax. But they only eliminated one part of the carbon tax. The industrial carbon tax is still in place, which is a huge burden upon our industry. It's happening in this province. And we also have the low carbon fuel emission standard, which is another carbon tax. That's a hidden tax. You don't see it, but you're paying 17 to 18 cents a liter for it at the pumps. And so it's no wonder why our gas prices are still high in this province.
Now, David Eby's Trump trade tariffs campaign will continue pretty quickly. He's going on a trade mission overseas, going to Japan, South Korea, and Malaysia, all important markets that British Columbia should be doing more trade back and forth with. I find it interesting, though, that the NDP has made a lot of hay about their trade office in Taipei, in Taiwan. And Taiwan has been quite aggressive internationally, wanting to do more trade around the world. There are flights every day from Vancouver to Taipei. Do you think it's a mistake for David Eby to skip Taiwan?
Well, I think one of the big mistakes that David Eby and the NDP have made is they shut down all of our trade offices. We had 15 different offices, I think, around that they shut down. And now they're in the process of reopening and they're trying to do trade through our embassies that we have in various countries. That set us back significantly in terms of being able to expand our opportunities. One of the things I look at, for example, we produce a lot of canola in British Columbia. You take the canola, you press it, you get the canola oil from it, and then you have what's called rapeseed, which is what's left over, which is a good feedstock for animals. A significant market for us on that was China. And China has now put significant tariffs on our product that we produce so that it's no longer economical for us to sell that into China. And yet there is nothing, no no retaliatory, no commentary. There's nothing in regards to, you know, what China is doing here to British Columbia and to Canada. So there's lots going on that is questionable in terms of what David Eby is actually trying to do. It makes me think that this trade trip he's doing is more of a junket as opposed to being serious about expanding trade, given the way that the NDP have treated this trade file for the last 8 years.
And you refer to some of the controversial legislation tabled by the NDP. They've had to walk back part of it or delay part of it. They should have known better before tabling it, but they went ahead full speed ahead. You're talking about the Economic Stabilization Tariff Response Bill, which would have given them extraordinary power, the cabinet extraordinary power to bypass the legislature to deal with the Trump trade war. And then, of course, they tabled the Infrastructure Projects Bill that would have fast-tracked infrastructure projects, both public and private. And David Eby is on this new kick. He says he wants to cut red tape, which used to be something that the Free Enterprise Party used to be always wanting to do with cut red tape. But now David Eby wants to cut red tape, but to the point that he's even angered First Nations groups who are concerned about what this would mean. And there's also questions about cutting red tape in other contexts. For instance, the new wind power projects that BC Hydro is going to be going forward with, there's no environmental assessments. It's bypassing the entire environmental assessment regime.
Well, this is who David Eby is. He's an authoritarian. He's shown that whether it's the decision around policing, there's a decision around how other things work in this province. He likes to override other democracies. He doesn't respect the legislature. He doesn't respect the democratic process. And so he just wants his dictatorship. He wants to be able to go in and do the things the way he wants to do it. And he tells people, just trust us. Just trust us. I mean, those are going to be the scariest words that any government can ever say to the population, is trust us. I mean, it's always turned out bad anywhere anybody's ever said that in the world. But with regards to these bills that are moving forward, look, you have, even today, you've got the Union of BC Indian Chiefs, you've got all the First Nation leadership standing up with the UBCM, which is all the municipal leaders, condemning this, asking them to withdraw these bills. You've got environmental groups going after it. You've got business groups going after it. You've never seen all of these people allied together against a government before. And many of these are traditional allies of the NDP that are asking them to step aside and to not go this route. So it's going to be very interesting. I would not be surprised, especially with the pressure that we've been putting on them in the legislature on these things as well. I wouldn't be surprised if he backs down on some of this next week and delays it to the fall or even not moves forward with it entirely. David Eby is desperate. You know, I think he knows that his time is very limited within the NDP. I think his leadership is going to be significantly questioned by the NDP party, by members in the NDP party. And I think he is actually looking to have an election. He wants to run against Trump. He's been out doing testing. And all of this sort of stuff is to give him the authority and powers to do what he thinks is right, even though no other jurisdiction in Canada is asking for these powers. But he thinks that's the right thing to do. And I say, you know, if he wants to go to the polls and ask the people for this kind of authority, fly at her. We're ready to go to the election tomorrow if that's what it takes.
But do you think that the NDP could take that risk, try to get a bigger majority, go to the polls this fall after just a year?
It's interesting because they have been out in the field. They've been doing focus groups. They've been doing polling. They've been testing language. They've been out, in particular, in the battleground areas in both Surrey and in Richmond. Those are all the types of things you do to prep for an election. So they are doing the work. The question is whether they think it's there for them. But David Eby knows that if his window for going to election is now, and if he doesn't go now, then the likelihood is that he won't be leading the NDP party into the next election. And so he's got a window. And he's arrogant enough and power hungry enough that I suspect he is seriously considering going to the polls. And certainly as a Conservative Party, we're doing everything we can to prepare to be in a place where if they decide to go to the polls, we are going to make sure that we make the case for why we need the change in British Columbia and why the Conservative Party can bring that sort of prosperity and opportunity that people are looking for in British Columbia.
Now, law and order issues have been hand in hand with healthcare issues, addictions issues. And David Eby has sold himself as this premier who has a unique insight into the downtown East Side, yet his latest problem was the downtown east side czar that nobody knew about until recently. Michael Bryant, the former Ontario Liberal Attorney General, who was in the position. We were told it was going to pay $150,000, and then we were told it could pay up to $300,000. And then just this week, David Eby decided to stop it, to end the contract, pay him out for $75,000 for the work he's done already. And he blamed this on a communications problem. And I find it interesting because I remember in BC history, for instance, the whole situation with the BC Liberals and the harmonized sales tax, the HST during the Gordon Campbell years, Gordon Campbell and Colin Hanson, the finance minister at the time, they put the blame not on themselves, but on a communications issue. And same thing with David Eby on this issue with the downtown east side czar and the big contract. He blamed it on a communications issue that they didn't get around to issuing a news release. So what are your thoughts on this continuing problem with the downtown east side and how the NDP just has not done anything to make any improvements?
You know, it's interesting. You started off talking about Michael Bryant and this so-called czar that they hired to give the answers as to what to do down there. Well, look, hundreds of millions of dollars are spent annually in the downtown east side trying to help these people that are in such horrible conditions. There have been dozens, if not hundreds, of reports written by independent groups, written by the city, written by the province, written by nonprofits. This thing has been analyzed to death. And David Eby thought that he could get away with hiring a friend of his, somebody he knows very well, and somebody who used to be the head of, used to work with Civil Liberties, I believe it was the head of the legal aid in British Columbia and was let go under suspicious circumstances. So he knows this person well. He hired this person, kept it quiet, didn't bother putting any information out there. And as soon as the story broke in the media, and as soon as we started asking the hard questions, which need to be asked about why this person was hired, he bails. What does that say about hiring him? If he was hired to do a legitimate job, David Eby would have had no problem defending it. He would have no problem being out there saying, hey, this is the work he's doing. It's good work. It's valuable. It's going to give us the answer. And it's going to lead to success. But no, instead, he gets rid of him. He tries to sweep it under the carpet. What does that say about the character of David Eby, a person that we just talked about who is asking the people in the province of British Columbia to trust him when it comes to this authoritarian powers that he wants in the legislature? Ultimately, the solution to the downtown east side is very complex. But what's needed is a very different approach to dealing with addictions. We actually have to reopen some facilities for handling mentally ill people. There are people who have received brain damage who are not capable of looking after themselves. They need help. We need to have compassionate care for these people. We need to be able to have that kind of service available. We need to be able to significantly expand the addiction treatment for people that are suffering from addictions. Mental health is often connected with that. And we also have to do a different type. We have to make sure that we're funding abstinence-based treatment as well, not just handing out these so-called safe supply drugs and keeping people hooked on their addictions. There's a big shift if we want to solve it. That is the only way to solve it. We know the answer. We just don't have the political will to deal with it in British Columbia.
Now, going back to the speculation that the NDP could be looking at going to the polls sooner instead of later, possibly before the end of this year, is your party ready? I know that, of course, March 1st, the convention over in Nanaimo reaffirmed your leadership, but there are divisions in the party. You've called it growing pains. There have been squabbles over First Nations issues. There have been squabbles over transgender issues. And then there were three of the MLAs, Dallas Brody, Jordan Keeley, and Tara Armstrong, no longer with the caucus. They're sitting as independents. So you've got 41, started with 44. But where is your party at in potential readiness? And can it overcome these challenges to the unity?
Yeah, I mean, I think, quite frankly, we are actually in a pretty good place right now as a caucus. Everybody's working well. We're working together on issues. And sure, like any family, we have some differences of opinion. Of course we do. That's to be expected. I didn't look for a team that would be all singing from the same song sheet. I looked for people that were going to be strong and independent and be able to stand up and fight. At the same time, there are values that we are as the Conservative Party. For example, I mean, we respect parental rights. We want to clean up all this woke nonsense that's going on in our schools. We are going to repeal DRIPA, but we will keep using UNDRIP as we move forward with economic reconciliation. These are the types of things that we're going to do. We're going to be a heavy focus on tax relief, helping with the affordability issue, getting our economy going. All of these are things that we agree on as a caucus in terms of the stuff that is going forward. It's unfortunate that the three individuals decided to leave our caucus. They made that decision on their own. We have said that Dallas Bodie would not be welcomed back in, but we haven't said anything about the other two. But from our perspective, if there's an election tomorrow, I've been out touring on through the province. I've been meeting with business leaders. I've been meeting with community leaders, meeting with our members as well. And I can tell you that they are ready to go. They want to go today if we could in terms of an election. And yes, there'll be challenges, of course, because we don't have the long lead up time and all of that side of stuff. But we have had an unbelievable amount of people express interest and wanting to run for us, good quality individuals, mayors, former mayors, business leaders, as well as solid people from communities right across this province, already saying that they want to be part of what we're doing. They look at what we are doing in British Columbia as the only hope for really getting us on a different track, getting us out of this hole that's been dug by the NDP. And quite frankly, they're proud of the legacy that we can leave for British Columbia with that change. And so I'm very optimistic. If we get to that place of going to the polls, you're going to see, a campaign like probably like any other because of the vigor that is going to be put into it by the people on the ground in British Columbia.
Is the party planning anything throughout the summer to increase its visibility? What about you? Where will you be throughout the summer?
So, I mean, we're obviously going to be doing quite a campaign over the course of the summer, touring around, doing public events, party events, doing fundraising, putting our party in a strong position to going into the fall. The last few days, the legislature will be interesting to see what David Eby does, whether he backs down on some of these bills. I mean, he says he needs this to cut the red tape. And I just look at it this way. He spent 8 years building up the red tape and all the barriers to actually getting something done. And now he says he wants to do something about it. I mean, it's amazing to watch how he flip-flops around. That's not governance. That's not what the direction in this province needs. So we'll be out, talking to the people, engaging them with what we have as a vision for British Columbia, what we want to see happen. For example, there are 27 mines that could go forward in this province, representing over $100 billion of investment in BC. All the infrastructure that's needed to be able to support that. Those are the types of things that we want to be able to see moving forward in this province. And it sets a real difference between us and the NDP. Even when it comes to electricity and their movement of these wind projects, wind can be part of the mix, but they are not basal. They cannot be relied upon for our needs. So far this year, we're already net buying 6% of the power that we need from the United States. Last year, it was somewhere between 10 and 20%. The year before that, it was 10%. We are in an electricity shortage. AI and other demands that we have, and especially if we can get our economy going, is only going to put increasing demands on power. And there is no plan. What is the plan for the next 20 or 30 years? They're going out moving forward with a bunch of wind projects. And like I say, they're unreliable. All that's going to do is leave our grid more vulnerable and put us actually in a position where we could actually even see blackouts as early as this summer in key places like the Okanagan.
John Rustad, the leader of the Conservative Party of BC, the leader of the opposition in the British Columbia Legislature and the MLA for Nechaco Lakes. Thanks again.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Breaker.news podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In FocusTaiwan.tw, Lai's address outlines Taiwan of the world vision, says scholar. David Keegan, the former deputy director of the American Institute in Taiwan, said President Lai Ching-te's first anniversary address focused little on China. Keegan said Lai's Taiwan is, quote, not defined by China or cross-Taiwan Strait tensions, end quote, but focused on advancing internal prosperity and social and political stability. Meanwhile, the head of the United States Indo-Pacific Command, Admiral Sam Paparo, warned that on and off Chinese military exercises around Taiwan are not drills but, quote, rehearsals for a potential invasion and that China is on a, quote, dangerous course. In ABC News Australia, Victorian state budget cuts programs around gender equity and inclusion in sport. The Office for Women in Sport and Recreation and the Preventing Violence Through Sport Grants Program were both axed in Victorian Treasurer Jacqueline Symes' first budget. In Kyoto News, Japan Prime Minister sacks Farm Minister over controversial gifted rice gaffe. Shigeru Ishiba fired Farm Minister Taku Ito over a controversial remark that sparked public outrage amid soaring rice prices. At issue was Ito's remark at a weekend fundraising event that he receives so much rice from supporters that he is not buying any, drawing sharp rebuke from consumers and lawmakers as insensitive at a time when inflation has outpaced wage growth. He later apologized. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In Willamette Week, the Oregon Racing Commission no longer wants Oregonians to know the sources of its funding. The move caught Governor Tina Kotek by surprise. The commission's budget of about $4 million a year comes mostly from fees paid by companies that facilitate internet betting. Since at least 2013, the commission has published quarterly reports disclosing the value of the bets. In 2024, that dollar volume was $6.5 billion, more than half of the $11.26 billion bet on horses that year across the U.S. In Crosscut, Governor Ferguson says Trump tariff effects could be profound in Washington. Ferguson and two dozen politicians, labor unions, economic development organizations, and local governments are supporting a multi-state lawsuit against four of President Donald Trump's executive orders. The lawsuit in the U.S. Court of International Trade argued that Trump executive orders are unconstitutional because Congress is the only branch of government with the power to impose tariffs. Washington is one of the most trade-dependent states in the country, with nearly $120 billion in exports and imports moving through ports last year, according to the governor's office. And check out thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com for the stories behind these headlines. High pay for directors is okay and direct elections not needed, says Metro Vancouver ordered Deloitte report. And BC's Victoria Day history includes baseball. Read the stories behind the headlines. Go to thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate, so you won't stand alone, you won't stand
alone. The Virtual Nanaimo Bar. Brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to British Columbia's mining industry. It's worth $12 billion every year to the economy and employs 40,000 workers. It'll be even more important for building electric vehicles of the future. May is Mining Month in British Columbia. And you can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to bob at thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of May 25th, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 25th of May in 1977, Star Wars opened in theaters? And in 1986, Hands Across America, 5.5 million people joined in human chains to raise $15 million to fight hunger and poverty. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob at thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. And introducing bobmackin.substack.com. Visit me there too. And sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox, or follow The Breaker News as news happens on X, formerly Twitter. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $7 a month. For more information, go to bobmackin.substack.com. Until next week.